Not to put too fine a point on it, but sometimes Janet Yellen doesn't know what's going on either. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KUOW in Seattle, Washington, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So here I sit in Seattle, not able for a whole bunch of reasons to have been able to watch Fed Chair Janet Yellen's press conference this afternoon. So I said to my producer back in L.A., I said, hey, just pull a couple of pieces of tape for me, something nice and zippy, and we'll use those. Once she stopped laughing, because really, Kai, zippy tape from the Fed? We figured it out. Here is the deal from Chair Yellen. Economy is basically doing fine, she said, but she does have some worries.
I recognize, and it's important, that inflation has been running under our 2% objective for a number of years, and that is a concern.
That much we've known, she says it all the time, but why, Chair Yellen, is it happening?
This year, the shortfall of inflation from 2%.
Here it comes.
Is more of a mystery.
Oh, so next time somebody tells you the economy is hard, tell them Janet Yellen doesn't always have it figured out. Either there were harsh words for Wells Fargo and Equifax as well, but the general gist, steady as she goes, data will be her guide. All right, so healthcare, as we have been alluding to these past several days, it looks like it's happening. The latest and possibly last try at repealing the Affordable Care Act is going to go up for a vote in the Senate next week. Among some of its other provisions, the Cassidy-Graham bill, as in Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy, takes the money the federal government spends on Obamacare and gives it directly to the states in what are called block grants, and then those states decide how that money gets spent. It sounds simple enough. It is, however, not. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has the breakdown on block grants.
At its most basic,
a block grant is a lump sum of money that doesn't change as the number of people might change or as the per unit cost of whatever it is you're buying changes.
That's Sarah Rosenbaum of George Washington University. She says that works fine when it comes to something with a fixed cost, like building a bridge or repaving a highway.
For healthcare, however, where the block grant is for a good or a service that goes up quite significantly faster than the general rate of inflation, that's certainly a challenge.
In the Graham-Cassidy bill, block grants won't cover as many people as Obamacare, particularly in states that expanded Medicaid. In fact, according to health policy firm Avalere, 34 states would get less money. George's Benjamin is with the American Public Health Association. He says this brings to mind another controversial block grant program, welfare reform.
Well, we used to give dollars based on need, and now many welfare dollars go out in blocks of money, and they often don't meet the need.
Others use the same example as evidence that block grants can work. David Howard is with Emory University.
Welfare reforms use a block grant formula, and as a result, some states were able to make changes to their welfare programs that reduced the number of people on welfare.
That's the big selling point for block grants. States get to decide how to spend the money, even if they get less of it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
You got your goods in this economy, the tangible stuff we all buy, and then you got your services, the things that people or computers do for consumers that we also buy. And that gets us, in an only slightly roundabout way, to iOS 11, the new operating system that Apple is pushing out. Along with that update, Apple is redesigning its App Store to make it easier for users to find new apps and increase an already big part of that company's revenue stream. Apple's services business, dominated by apps, makes more money for the company than, it turns out, sales of Macs or iPads do. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why you would want to mess with something that is working.
When it comes to mobile apps, a lot of folks are like 26-year-old Alex Capobianco in New York.
Take out my phone and look what I got on there.
It's pretty much the go-tos.
Snapchat, Facebook, Uber.
Andrew Lipsman is with the research firm Comscore.
We are seeing that mobile in general is reaching a state of maturity. So there's not quite as much excitement about new apps as there was maybe a few years ago.
But there is still plenty of life and money in apps. Apple's services segment brought in nearly $7.3 billion last quarter, up more than 20% over last year. Apple, with this redesign, clearly thinks it can do even better. And so does Angelo Zeno, an analyst at CFRA Research.
There's probably significant room for Apple to get more users within their app store actually downloading apps.
Apple is also investing in augmented reality, hoping those apps could get us jazzed and willing to spend. There are big margins in apps for Apple. It takes 30% of most purchases. Ben Schachter is an analyst at Macquarie Securities.
It is a very, very profitable model for them because they're not really providing much of the service other than some credit card fees and advertising for the App Store. Other than that, it's essentially a close to 100% margin business for them.
And what company wouldn't want more of that? I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh, look, another record, or as Chair Yellen would say, elevated asset prices. We will have the details when we do the numbers. This is going to sound like kind of an apocalyptic question, but it is all too real for the people of Puerto Rico right now. How do you get an already beaten down economy back up and running when there is literally no electricity? You cannot turn the lights on. By midday today, the entire island was without power in the wake of Hurricane Maria. There is massive flooding, damage to buildings and the public infrastructure besides the power grid. And the ramifications are only going to play out over the long economic term, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
2 weeks ago, Hurricane Irma knocked out power to two-thirds of Puerto Rico's electric customers. The power was mostly restored, then came Maria. Carlos Mercader is with the Puerto Rico Governor's Office in Washington, D.C.
We knew that the electric infrastructure in general, would get hit. Our main priority right now is to save lives. I cannot tell you what it's going to cost to repair the electric grids.
Puerto Rico's grid was already in bad shape, strapped for cash with millions in deferred maintenance.
You have an aging infrastructure.
Analyst Rick Donner at Moody's Investor Service covers the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, known as PREPA, which filed for bankruptcy last July.
PREPA has very high rates compared to the U.S. mainland, largely because of the high cost of oil. Most of their electricity is produced by oil-fired generation. To pay for significant capital improvements, that would necessitate even higher rates.
Which could hurt the slumping economy even more. Donner says PREPA's management and line workers actually did a good job shutting down operations before the storms hit, so there'd be less damage and a faster restart. But Mary Ellen Tai at Debtwire Municipals says the recovery could be challenging.
PREPA has not been replacing older employees as they quit, so that there's some institutional knowledge that has walked out the door.
In fact, skilled workers have been walking out the door, migrating to the mainland U.S. for decades, creating a brain drain that might also make reconstruction more difficult. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One of the things not easily captured in the economic statistics that go with the big storms we've had the past couple of weeks is people just donating their time, helping a neighbor, pitching in, doing what they can to rebuild their communities. And that gets us to this next installment of our series, My Economy.
I am Monica Pope. I'm in Houston, Texas. Since I was 17, I've had this single-minded goal to open a restaurant and change the way Houston eats. I think back in the day, we just weren't connected. We didn't feel like a community. Over the few years, there's just been a big shift in this farm-to-table thing, which we did not have a label for 20-some-odd years ago. It's all a piece, you know, the local community, the local farmers finding each other, which took a long time before Harvey. You know, I saw us come together. Everybody now believing we've got to go out to eat, we've got to keep buying local, we've got to go to our farmer's market on Saturday and say hi to everybody and drop money, whatever table we can drop it in, something. You know, we care about each other and we're a much tighter group. We know it's hard. We all have to make our decisions about, you know, how we're going to go on. I'm cooking tomorrow for 50 people that are underwater. You know what I mean? And that's what I do. I do it in a field, or I do it in somebody's backyard or home, or I'm going to do it in Nottingham Forest underwater. We all want to feel better doing something. And so I think I feel better doing what it is I do anyway, which is bring people together and let them have a meal and take a little respite. And that's how I participate.
Houston chef and restaurateur Monica Pope. This is one of those series we cannot do without you. If you've got a story to share, send it our way. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. We did a quick series of stories a bit more than a year ago following a family of Syrian refugees from the moment they arrived in Connecticut through their first couple of months here as they try to get settled and build a new life. Lots obviously has changed since then for the family and for U.S. refugee policy. The Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on President Trump's travel ban in early October. But in the meanwhile, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson filed this update on the family and their first year in the United States.
Look at my bicycle.
Yeah. Ali, Fatima, and their four kids have moved into a sweet yellow house with a grassy backyard. Five-year-old Bayan, the oldest, is this little sponge. She's just rocking English.
As I push me, please.
Push you, please. Thank you. Such nice manners. Ali brings a hose over to a small vegetable garden the family's planted next to the driveway. What are you growing?
This tomato.
Eggplant.
Parsley, this?
Parsley?
Yeah.
The family's putting down roots. Ali has his driver's license and a part-time job at the Cheesecake Factory. He tells me about when Connecticut started to feel like home. It was family day at his daughter's school. She showed the class a picture she'd drawn of her dad cutting her brother's hair.
Everybody was clapping and everybody was really encouraging her as their own kids. So I didn't feel that I am a stranger in this community.
But for all the change over the last year, one thing has remained. Ali and Fatima are still really worried about money.
Yeah, rent is here is expensive.
Their rent is about $1,000. Fatima and Ali are still relying on a group of local volunteers for emotional and occasional financial support. Normally, refugees get transitional help from a local nonprofit, but an organization in New Haven called IRIS is training local volunteer groups to take on that role. Any financial support is supposed to stop at 6 months.
We've already doubled that.
Terry Schmidt is the leader of the volunteer group assisting Ali and Fatima.
We would love to be in a situation where they didn't need us or turn to us for anything unless there was a real crisis. I don't think that's where we're at, and it's where we should be.
Ali's only working about 20 hours a week. Fatima is home with the kids. Their English is still really limited, and Ali has this bad back injury. He fell off his motorcycle during an airstrike back in Syria. So while the group's trying not to give Ali and Fatima any more financial support, the family's still at least $12,000 short on their annual expenses. And they still call the group if anything goes wrong. For example, when Fatima broke a tooth.
I think we're a little too comfortable being turned to. So they're not as independent as we would like them to be or as they should be.
IRIS has placed 58 refugee families with volunteer groups so far. About 65% were self-sufficient by that six-month mark, about 90% after a year. As a result, IRIS wants to better train volunteers to practice tough love with refugees and find them affordable housing.
Look at me, I'll go up the hill.
Okay, let's see you do it all by yourself.
I got it. Go up the hill.
Back in the yard, Fatima brings out strong, sweet coffee. We all watch the kids ride their bikes in circles on the driveway.
I was just thinking about how far you've come to have this kind of normalcy here.
Yeah, every day we will come here just to spend some time with them, to get them out of the house.
I ask Ali what he wants for his kids now that they're here. Without hesitating, he says he wants them to be doctors.
Because he will be able to take the pain from other people.
He says he wants his children to be able to give back to the country that helped them. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
coming up.
So that is how I ended up with pumpkin spice deodorant.
I don't even know what to say. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 41 points today, about a 10%, finished at 22,412. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ down 5, less than a 10%, 6,456. S&P 500 basically flat, 2,508 there. We talked about Apple's new look for its App Store earlier. In less upbeat news, Apple acknowledged today that its latest smartwatch has some problems connecting to cellular networks. A software fix is going to have to be made, the company said. Investors said, no. Share sank 1.6% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.26%. Thank you very much, Janet Yellen. We're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Turnover is a problem everywhere. Losing good trained people is expensive and time-consuming. It's true in business, and it's also true in education. By one estimate, half of new school principals leave the job after just 3 years. That's among the highest turnover rates in any slice of this economy. It's a leadership job, principal is, that requires expertise in both curriculum and instruction and in running what can be multi-million dollar enterprises. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott checked out one training program that is trying to develop more of those kinds of people.
Eric Bethel is about to deliver some bad news to a tough crowd, a room full of school principals.
All right, so, team, there are some key data points that we need to look at.
Actually, he's only practicing to give the bad news to an even tougher crowd. In a few days, Bethel will have to tell his teachers at Turner Elementary in Washington that they'll all have to start doing lunch duty this year to supervise behavior. Bethel is part of an executive master's degree program for principals at Georgetown University. Today's lesson is about difficult conversations. Rehearsing with his peers, he starts with the data.
First of all, it's important to note that last year we had 1,865 behavior referrals.
He doesn't get very far before the constructive criticism starts.
All of this is really nice, and I'm sitting here like, okay, what are you trying to tell me? Yeah. Tell them what it is first, and then tell them why.
The program, housed in Georgetown's business school, was created by management professor Bob Beese. 20 principals, half from traditional public schools and half from charter schools, come to campus every other weekend for a year. Beese says most principals are trained in education programs that focus on curriculum and teaching methods.
But the reality is they are running organizations. So it requires staffing, requires issues around how do you manage people, it requires issues about budgets.
Thinking of principals as CEOs is part of a trend some teachers and public school advocates find worrying. With the rise of vouchers and for-profit charter school management companies, there's growing concern about the privatization of public education. Jake Lappy, director of academic support at Achievement Prep Charter School, is in the program.
I think that's a very legitimate concern, but I think you can still glean from best practices from businesses while still keeping our scholars and our families at the core.
Some of those business skills include communicating in a crisis and doing what's called a stakeholder analysis before making a big change. Sunday Riggins, principal of Hendley Elementary in Southeast D.C., says she especially liked the course on negotiation.
They definitely changed my perspective on being able to advocate for things that I need for my school in a respectful way and maybe get someone to see something from my perspective.
Eric Bethel from Turner Elementary says having a better grasp on all the different hats principals have to wear could help with high turnover.
I think principals run out of gas because there's so many things to do. The better you can do those things, the better you can organize that work. The better school leader you are, the more sustainable it is.
After a lunch break, it's back to class, where Bethel practices delivering his bad news in front of the whole group. This time, he starts with a story of a food fight in the lunchroom to get the group's attention, and then cuts to the chase.
Because of that story and a bunch of other reasons that we'll discuss soon, this school year, all of you will be participating in lunch duty.
No.
I want to acknowledge that is a change and that it is some loss or perceived loss of time. All right, y'all.
So he doesn't nail it, but he's got a few more days to practice before the real thing. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There are times on this program I regret what I have said. It's not often, but every now and then. And today is one of them. Not too long ago, I declared victory over the shark jumping of pumpkin spice, and I said I would never speak of it again. And then Maura Judkis of the Washington Post one-upped me. She spent a week buying every pumpkin spice product she saw, yogurt, cookies, pasta sauce, the basics, I guess, but also candles and deodorant and all kinds of other stuff. So we had to call her up to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you do this?
Well, you know, there are so many more pumpkin spice themed products that we're seeing in stores year after year. And, you know, I wondered what would happen if I actually just bought every single one that I encountered in the course of just regular grocery shopping in a week.
Did you go looking or was it serendipity? You know, did you like come across the pumpkin Cheerios in the aisles, or did you say, I need a box of pumpkin flavored Cheerios?
A little bit of both. I mean, I was going to different grocery stores in the Washington, D.C. area. I went to Target, a Giant, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's to see what they had. But then also, you know, if I encountered something online, I would buy it. So that is how I ended up with pumpkin spice deodorant.
Yes, of which I have spoken before on this program. Here's the thing, though, at least for the edibles in this. It's not, you say, really about the pumpkin as a flavor. It's more like cinnamon and clove and other stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's pumpkin is not even necessarily an ingredient in a lot of these products, actually. Sometimes it's just pumpkin powder. Sometimes it's not even present in the ingredient list at all. But, you know, you get this mix of cinnamon and clove and nutmeg and ginger and allspice, and it just reminds you of pumpkin pie and of the holidays, and it gives you this warm, nostalgic, and kind of loving feeling that a lot of, you know, a lot of companies want you to feel that when you think of their products, of course.
Where did pumpkin spice come from? I mean, you did some research.
So the Washington Post might be partially to blame, actually. we're sorry, and you're welcome. So pumpkin pie spice was packaged and sold as a blend in the 1950s for the first time. But before that, there was a pumpkin spice cake recipe that ran in the Washington Post in 1936. And it is the first reference that we could find to pumpkin spice together. There are other recipes that involve pumpkin and use some of these spices, but no one really called it a pumpkin spice cake or a pumpkin spice bread until we did, unfortunately.
You point out at the end of this article that while there are more products than ever available that have pumpkin spice in some form, sales are actually down.
Well, they're just not growing as quickly as they have in previous years. Yeah. So we're seeing, you know, more and more pumpkin spice products than ever. I think one market research firm found that there are 50% more pumpkin spice products available online this year than the previous year. But people who have been researching this have found that sales are not growing as quickly, anywhere between only 6 to 20% over previous years. And in other years, we've seen much more growth. So we could be seeing the beginning of the end of pumpkin spice everything.
Yeah, think about 6% growth, though. So at the end of your week in pumpkin spice land, what's your verdict? What was your mood? How did you feel?
I felt really embarrassed, first of all, because I was going to grocery stores and I looked like a crazy person. I had cartloads of pumpkin spice stuff. Everything in my cart was orange, and it was like cookies and candies and coffee and tea and sweets. And so I must have looked really crazy. I was, doing the self-checkout aisle everywhere because I didn't want to invite the judgment of these cashiers who must have thought I was the world's biggest pumpkin spice fan.
Maura Judkis from the Washington Post writing about all things pumpkin spice. Maura, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, you want record highs on the Dow? I'll give you record highs on the Dow. Or more accurately, Warren Buffett will. Buffett, who one must assume knows a little something about investing, said this week that he thinks in another 100 years, the Dow could be above a million. I know, right? But here's the thing. It would take, the Wall Street Journal did the math, it would take a 3.9% annual gain for the Dow to hit seven figures by September of 2117. And if you look back, as the Journal did, the Dow has been up almost 6% annually on average for the 100 years that ended Tuesday. So there's your record. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 41 today, a 10%. Not quite a million, but, you know, baby steps. NASDAQ and the S&P 500 basically flat. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. Thanks today to the folks here at KUOW. Back in L.A. tomorrow, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see everybody. Oh, and this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.